From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The official raison d'etre of the International Monetary Fund is to prevent and extinguish financial crises. But in fact, in the way they have operated, they have done more than all other factors together to create and worsen those financial crises.
Today, a teach-in on the World Bank and the IMF. Seven environmentalists are arrested as tension heats up in Washington for preparations for closing the World Bank and IMF this Sunday and Monday. And a look at a call for a boycott of World Bank bonds. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Nearly 5 months after Elian Gonzalez was rescued at sea, his Miami distant relatives are finally taking tentative, reluctant steps toward returning the six-year-old boy to his father. Elian's great-uncle, Lazaro Gonzalez, met for an hour yesterday with two psychiatrists and a psychologist sent by the government to arrange Elian's smooth transfer to his father. The doctors who met with Elian's father in Washington, D.C. on Sunday are expected to discuss the situation again today with federal officials. Although the family still hopes for a reprieve from a federal appeals court, many in Miami's Cuban exile community acknowledge that the chances are slim. Fraud is on the lips of Peruvians in the capital streets after election officials say that President Alberto Fujimori is just shy of the majority of votes needed to win an unprecedented third term. Officials said after counting more than half the ballots that Fujimori has 49.6% compared to Alejandro Toledo's 40.6. That defied exit polls and unofficial vote tallies by independent monitors that indicated he would not reach the 50% plus one vote needed to avoid a runoff. The first results were made public at midday, more than 12 hours later than election officials had promised, prompting suspicion of dirty play. Eight California prison guards go on trial today for allegedly staging gladiator-style fights among prisoners. Four of the Corcoran State prison guards face possible life sentences for the shooting of a prisoner during one of the brawls in 1994. An FBI agent has said it appears the fights were staged, even provoked, for the amusement of correctional officers or retribution against prisoners. Defense attorneys say the guards were just following the state's, quote, integrated yard policy that forced inmates of different ethnic and geographic backgrounds to exercise together. The policy has since been rescinded. Corcoran State is south of Fresno and is considered one of California's most dangerous prisons. A veteran U.S. immigration officer has been found guilty of allowing 3,550 pounds of marijuana and 25 undocumented immigrants pass through his inspection lane at the San Ysidro point of entry in Southern California. The federal jury deliberated for about 2 days before announcing its verdict yesterday against Richard Lawrence Pineda, a senior inspector now on administrative leave from the INS. Pineda was found guilty on 12 counts, including smuggling conspiracy, was found innocent of taking money for the cursory inspections. Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon says he believes the city's striking janitors will soon be back at work. He says he expects their wages will be boosted to somewhere near what they're asking. The strike of 4,000 janitors who clean the city's high-rise office buildings is in its eighth day. The striking workers attended a mass celebrated by Cardinal Roger Mahoney after rallying downtown. The mayor says he thinks the strike will be settled within 24 hours. Similar strikes are taking place in other cities around the country. This news from San Francisco. Immigration officials cannot hold criminal immigrants indefinitely after their prison sentences when their home countries won't take them back. This according to a federal appellate panel in a ruling that may go to the Supreme Court. Yesterday's 3-0 ruling by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals affects hundreds of immigrants in the nine western states covered by the nation's largest appellate circuit. The Immigration and Naturalization Service estimated a year ago there were 3,500 such prisoners being held nationwide. For the most part, they're legal U.S. residents who committed felonies in this country, served their sentences, and were then ordered deported under a 96 law greatly expanding the types of crimes that require deportation. But they cannot return to their homelands because they come from countries that have no repatriation agreements with the United States. And this news from Cuba. Leaders from the world's developing countries meeting in Cuba plan to focus on winning debt relief and finding ways to increase their involvement in the world's knowledge-based economy. The gathering is the first time that the 133-nation Group of 77, founded in 64, is holding a summit at the level of heads of state. Until now, the organization has been a bloc within the United Nations. The organization's chair, Arthur Mbanefo of Nigeria, told a news conference yesterday the summit would look for ways to help poorer nations fit into an increasingly wired world, despite problems such as power and telephone shortfalls that make internet connections difficult.
I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed.
Talk about greed.
Greed is
the problems of Africa, the problems of Mozambique, of Kenya, the problems of Latin America started centuries ago. They started with slavery. They started with colonialism. They started with apartheid.
We have a bill for a total cancellation of our debts.
Those people, we don't owe them anything. They owe us a life.
And that money should be used for long-term development within social areas, particularly education and health.
We have to remember that the World Bank and the IMF, they have also supported criminal regimes in the third world. They also share the criminal responsibility. They supported Pinochet. They supported the criminal governments in Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua. Criminal people should be punished.
Away the debt, away!
Possess and to buy. Nothing seems to stop it once it enters your soul. As you buying anything, spending out of control. It moves within the culture, touching us all. Greed really isn't picky, it'll make anybody fall.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! With Sweet Honey in the Rock singing Greed. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez today, a teach-in on the World Bank and the IMF. Welcome, Juan. It's great to have you back.
Good day, Amy. I'm glad to be back after spending several days in Puerto Rico last week. But I see as we're getting closer and closer to the new gathering here of the IMF and the World Bank in Washington, D.C., the forces of globalization continue to find something they'd never expected, a global people's movement rapidly developing.
That's right, Juan. We certainly saw it in Seattle with the battle in Seattle, and not to compare what's happening here in Washington, but the level of mobilization and the excitement around the country, particularly among young activists, is really something. This is clearly just the beginning, whatever the number of people that actually gather in Washington this weekend.
And, of course, it's not an isolated movement. In the past few days, there have been massive protests in Bolivia over the issue of the government attempting to essentially privatize and begin charging for water supply. And there were massive protests, several people killed in a number of cities, and the effort was being bankrolled by international companies like the Edison Company and others that were attempting basically to start charging Bolivians for their water.
And Bolivia has cracked down. It was interesting to note they have declared martial law, but that's exactly what happened on the streets of Seattle. The Seattle mayor, for the first time since World War II, declaring martial law in Washington State. Well, the protests have definitely begun. Yesterday, seven activists were arrested after demonstrating outside the World Bank's headquarters in Washington. They were protesting the bank's environmental record, part of a week of rallies against the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and their effects on poor nations. Two activists representing an international coalition of environmental, human rights, religious, and social justice groups locked themselves to the undercarriage of a 17-foot panel truck emblazoned with the words, "World Bank plunders the planet, no more dollars for oil, gas, and mining." Using the top of the truck as a makeshift stage, Friends of the Earth and Ozone Action are waging a campaign demanding the World Bank phase out the financing of projects they say are destructive to the environment. We're joined on the phone right now by someone who was arrested yesterday. John Passacantando is executive director of Ozone Action. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
Well, can you tell us why exactly you got arrested and what you did?
Well, yes. Ozone Action, we work exclusively to stop global warming. And here comes this this whole gathering of activists working on a lot of issues, but all focused on the World Bank and the IMF and globalization. And we started talking with our friends at Friends of the Earth and discovered that we could work on this action with them as the World Bank's Energy Committee meeting began yesterday. And so we coordinated an action with a number of activists. It wasn't Brent Blackwelder from Friends of the Earth and I were on the top of the truck, as was Becca Economopoulos from a group called EcoPledge.com. But there were a lot of other activists all involved in this. But we work on global warming. Friends of the Earth works on reforming the World Bank. And we looked at it and we said, wow, the World Bank is the world's single largest funder of global warming. So they are a problem for Ozone Action. They fund 25 times more projects that cause global warming than those projects that support sustainable energy. And even if you're more domestically focused, the World Bank takes $1 billion of American taxpayer dollars every year, and it gives it to companies that don't need it, companies like ExxonMobil, Shell, Chevron, Enron. And worse still, not only do they take your $1 billion, but they use that $1 billion to destroy rainforests, to move indigenous peoples off their land. The World Bank's own accounting estimates that their current portfolio will displace 2.6 million people around the world from their homeland and from their jobs. This is a bad, bad thing. Now, this is an organization that is, up until this sort of beginning of these mass mobilizations, has been very difficult for the public to get their arms around, because you can't vote to remove James Wolfensohn, head of the World Bank, from the World Bank. So now you've got to go right to his door, and that's what we started yesterday.
If I can ask you, in terms of some of the concrete examples of how the World Bank, which is supposed to be an organization, obviously, that attempts to ameliorate conditions of poverty around the world, could you give us some of the concrete examples of some of these projects that are involved in contributing and to the problems of global warming or the displacements of peoples?
Yes, well, in some ways, the way it works, you know, Chet, there's a pipeline proposed, in fact, fast-tracked by the World Bank across Western Africa in the countries of Chad and Cameroon right now, that are in the name of supplying energy to people, including people in the developing world. But all it does is it's subsidizing companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron to get fossil fuels out of pristine rainforests that they'll export around the world. And what they'll do is they'll destroy pristine forests to do it, and they'll push indigenous people out of their way to do it. So sort of in the name of providing energy for the world, which can sound so good on paper, what you're doing is you're causing global warming, you're pushing people off their land, and you're really just feeding the appetites of the industrialized world that already knows it needs to use fewer fossil fuels, not more. So the World Bank's money, subsidized by those of us in the United States, heavily subsidized, is adding to the problem. It's making the world worse, not better. World Bank was created to make the world a better place, not a worse place. So that's why people are protesting. That's why they're out in front of the World Bank.
John Passacantando, Executive Director of Ozone Action, you had a list of the different oil and gas projects around the world funded by the World Bank. Could you go through further that list?
I would love to, but I'm holding a sick two-year-old baby, and that list is in my briefcase in another car. So I would love to, but I somehow got separated from my my materials early this morning as I woke up. My wife and I were ready to commute into Washington, and one of our two girls was ill, and I stayed home with the sick one.
Well, you're lucky that you were able to stay home. I know that for a lot of families that wouldn't be the case, so we're not going to keep you from your child any longer.
Thank you.
If people want to get more information and get that list, where can they go on the web?
Well, the best place would be to call our allies at Friends of the Earth. Andrea Durbin is the one who really led the charge in putting together this group of nonprofits from around the world, more than 200 groups from 55 countries who all signed onto this platform calling on the World Bank to phase out the financing of these oil, gas, and mining projects. And Friends of the Earth, I'm sure just with a little search engine, you'll find...
That's FOE.org.
That's right. That's right. And they've got all of that up there and lots of information on all these particular projects. And I, only a half an hour ago, had them in my hands as well and don't want to start riffing on them and get any of them wrong.
Well, John, one final question. Given your experience yesterday with law enforcement in Washington, D.C., do you get the sense that they're any more prepared for the activities that are about to come up than the folks in Seattle were?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that. Our experience with the police yesterday in both the Metropolitan D.C. police and the Secret Service was that they weren't quite ready for the action we pulled off yesterday with our truck pulling up at the same time our climbers were trying to take a banner up the facade of the World Bank. But they knew that, we were not the enemy, and we knew that they were not the enemy. And we were there to do a job, and their job was to make sure things stayed peaceful. So as we pulled up on that big truck, we were very conscious to leave the back of the truck open, so they knew that nothing funny was going on. When we popped up on the top of the truck, the first words out of our mouths were, "This is a peaceful, nonviolent demonstration." And the cops, they handled us very professionally, I would say, the whole day. And if the police may continue to do that, and we activists, which I'm confident will continue to have our emphasis on getting this word out through these peaceful, nonviolent actions, we will be able to show the country that Washington is a place where we're used to protest, where we, as part of our democracy, we protest in this town. So I was very pleased. That was one of the things we wanted to accomplish yesterday. We wanted to sort of kick off one of the first big actions in a very professional and a very peaceful way.
Well, John Passacantando, thank you very much for being with us, Executive Director of Ozone Action, one of seven people who were arrested protesting yesterday the World Bank and the IMF. Demonstrations are heating up in Washington around both organizations. Tomorrow, a major AFL-CIO rally planned to protest China's entrance into the World Trade Organization, and we'll have a debate on that issue tomorrow on Democracy Now! But today, in this series of teach-ins that we'll have on the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, we're going to take a look at the history of the World Bank and the IMF. Many people use the names interchangeably, but the institutions were originally created with different roles. I just got the newsletter of Global Exchange, and they have an article called The IMF and World Bank, Global Rulemakers. And they say the World Bank and the IMF were created near the end of World War II by the U.S. and British governments. During the war, the business class of Europe had either supported the Nazis or fled Europe with their wealth. But socialists, communists, and anarchists enjoyed popular support since they'd led the resistance to Nazism. In order to prevent leftists from coming to power, the U.S. and Britain decided to create international institutions that would promote free market policies and strengthen the power of the corporate sector. After an initial focus in Western Europe, the World Bank shifted its lending to finance railroads, bridges, and other infrastructures in the global South. The IMF was established to smooth global commerce by making foreign currency exchanges easier and using its reserve funds to lend countries experiencing temporary cash flow problems so that they could continue to trade without interruption. But according to critics, the unwritten goal of both institutions was to consolidate power and wealth in the hands of a few and to maintain existing power relations. Well, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Cheryl Payer. She is a well-known critic of the World Bank and the IMF, has written a number of books on the subject, including The Debt Trap, the International Monetary Fund, and the Third World. She'll talk to us about the history of both institutions. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and our guest is Cheryl Payer. She is the author of many books on the World Bank and the IMF, including The Debt Trap, The International Monetary Fund and the Third World, The World Bank, A Critical Analysis, as well as Lent and Lost, Foreign Credit and Third World Development.
Well, Cheryl, tell us a little more about the origins of the bank in terms of the development, especially in the focus in terms of the Third World.
Well, when the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank were founded, they were founded at two conferences, one in 1944 at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, from which we get the title the Bretton Woods Institutions and the Bretton Woods System, and then the founding conference in 1946 in Savannah, Georgia. At that time, of course, most of the present members of the United Nations and the Fund and the Bank were still colonies, so they weren't present. The Third World was very much an afterthought. The Latin American countries were there and a few other nominally independent ones like Thailand and Ethiopia, I believe, but basically they lined up either behind the United States or Great Britain, which was represented by John Maynard Keynes. And therefore, they were really not players in the original founding. However, Keynes, who I consider to be one of the greatest economists of the century, though he's in eclipse now, he was representing the interest of the debtors because Great Britain, being closer to the war and more damaged by it, was coming out of the war as being one of the great debtor countries. So Keynes was really representing the interest of the South, though he didn't realize it at the time, and he himself was rather contemptuous of them in his remarks.
And how did they both get started? I mean, what does it mean to say there were these founding conferences?
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, it's the United States getting together with the other countries, and the other countries basically had Keynes as an intellectual giant who was trying to provide a counterweight to the power of the United States, but he was not very successful. And as a matter of fact, just a month before his death, he gave a toast at the Savannah Conference, the founding conference, which was extremely bitter. He compared it to the christening party in Sleeping Beauty, where the uninvited bad fairy shows up and pronounces a curse. And, of course, he did it very gracefully, but it was quite obvious that he intended the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury as the bad fairy.
And what do you think of that analysis of the World Bank and the IMF having been founded to consolidate corporate power? Because, in fact, the corporate power in World War II was pretty much allied with the Nazis, with Hitler.
I don't think that's entirely true, but you've got to remember America was a very different world back then. We believed in free employment. In the post-war world, we passed a law that said, full employment, I mean, we passed a law that said we should have full employment, and the conference was giving at least lip service to the desire that countries had to prevent an episode like the 1929 crash and the depression that followed. And the intent of these organizations was supposed to be to allow countries to follow full employment policies while still using the resources of the institutions as sort of an extension of their own foreign exchange reserves.
Now, what are the, for those who do not follow the activities of the World Bank and IMF on a regular basis, in the division of labor between them, what are the specific roles supposed to be of the IMF and the World Bank individually?
Well, they've always had some problems with this. But in theory and originally, the IMF was supposed to be a source of short-term balance of payments loans. And the World Bank's original name was the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And it was assumed when it was founded that it would provide a great deal of the capital needed for the rebuilding of Europe after the war. Now, this, in fact, didn't happen because the procedures were too cumbersome. It couldn't move the money fast enough. Its criteria were too stringent in terms of repayment. And so in the end, the United States invented the Marshall Plan to do the job that the World Bank was originally designed to do.
So in other words, the World Bank would be more in normal local government parlance, it would be responsible for capital investment versus the actual operating budget problems or financing problems of a government.
Yes, it was originally designed to be to provide long-term development for capital projects which were supposed to be profitable but not quite profitable enough to be attractive to foreign investment. And this has been a very, very hard line to tread, actually, to avoid both treading on unprofitable areas and getting in the way of projects that private capital would be interested in supporting.
And in terms, then, of the role that they've taken on, especially in recent years, I know, having traveled to many third world countries, when an IMF team arrives in a third world country, it is the major front page news because everyone knows that orders are going to come down about how the government has to change its spending. And, of course, here you'd hear almost no attention paid to IMF teams. But how did they develop this role almost as dictators of economic policy in many of these countries?
Well, I read a lot of uninformed comment these days that said it all happened in 1973 when the Bretton Woods system of par values broke down. In fact, it broke down much earlier. It broke down in 1946 when the IMF tried to get Britain to establish an untenable exchange rate, and they had to devalue very quickly, and they couldn't do it in consultation with the IMF, and they had to do it in great secrecy and great speed. And so it was realized almost immediately that this was not going to work. So the IMF began lending money to countries like Chile and other countries in Latin America. They did this already in the early 1940s. And by 1973, when I had basically completed my first book, The Debt Trap, I had a whole book full of case studies of how the IMF was actually dictating policies to these countries, and policies which was not solving their balance of payments problems, but actually worsening them. And believe me, I had a lot of case studies I didn't even have to use there. So it happened a lot earlier than that. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting to me that what we now call supply-side economics or Reaganomics was being pushed by the IMF as early as the 1950s, and it was developing an ideology which the supply-siders were certainly in tune with if they didn't actually borrow from. So the IMF was much more reactionary in this sense even than the American political system was.
Can you explain what the IMF and the World Bank do when they go into a country and the difference between what they each do?
Well, these days there's not a whole lot of difference because they've been converging, especially in their policy recommendations for the countries. There's much less of a distinction than there was intended to be in the beginning. And basically it's because they're both controlled by the same forces, meaning the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury and the corporate forces that influence the Secretary of the Treasury. And even though they're two institutions, they're sort of like two dogs on the same leash. They can growl at each other and they can pull in different directions, but they can't basically go off in different directions very far. What they do when they go into a country, or for that matter when they invite officials of the country to come to them in Washington, is that they say that we are not going to lend to you unless you do such and such. And there's a whole list of conditions they lay down. And furthermore, they have persuaded all the other sources of capital in the world from other aid organizations like the Norwegians and the French and the British and so forth, the other international organizations. And after the first few crises, at least, the private creditors, to follow their lead, to treat them as sort of a super credit agency for the third world. And therefore, this is the reason that their pronouncements are listened to.
Can you explain, when I was in Haiti during the coup, I went over to the U.S. Embassy and I was asking why USAID money was coming into Haiti. And he said, don't worry, as an American, you know, why isn't it just staying in the United States? That it does stay in the United States. We say this much money goes to Haiti, but in fact, it goes to U.S. corporations. So it means employment for people in the United States, something like 80% of it. Mm-hmm. Is that also true, for example, when you're talking about the World Bank, that while these you have a large pool of money that's given to a country, but it's not really given. They say you have to do this, this, and this with it. And then it goes to the various corporations of the countries that wield power within the World Bank.
Well, this brings me to one of the fundamentals of my criticism of the IMF. They have somehow persuaded these countries that there's something magical about foreign capital, capital that comes in from abroad. And really, there isn't anything magic about it. If you want to build schools, if you want to build roads, most countries, every country has the wherewithal to build schools physically and to build roads. You don't need foreign money for that. And when the World Bank lends money for roads and for schools and for things like this, it's basically just finding a way to push money into that country that the country really doesn't need. And yes, it's true that if it's paid for in foreign exchange, it will eventually go back to suppliers in the wealthy countries. And there's a great deal of competition among these suppliers to compete for aid contracts.
Now, I don't think most Americans are aware of the enormity of the debt crisis for many, especially countries in the third world. For instance, a country like Honduras, I think 35% to 40% of their national budget goes to pay off their external debt. Can you tell us a little bit about how the IMF has basically fostered or helped to push this development on foreign debt?
Well, yes. Let's start with the post-war period. After the Second World War, most of the countries of what we now call the South, or as I called in my book, the Third World, had a great deal accumulation of reserves because they'd been supplying the war effort and they hadn't been paid for it. So they had all these they were creditors at that time. So after the war, they were encouraged to spend down these credits, and they got in the habit of spending, as it's very easy to do, as you know. And they took out private suppliers' credits, and many of them overborrowed and got into a short-term payments crunch. And this is when the IMF is able to come in and impose its conditions. And if you examine the conditions, they are really quite extraordinary because, you know, if you as an individual or as a family get into a payments crunch, what you do is you sit down and you make a budget and you decide what you really need and what you can do without, what's not so essential. And maybe you take out a loan, but if you're prudent, you don't take out very much of a loan, or you do it only for exceptional circumstances. What the IMF did when it went into these countries was it was saying basically throw out your budget. Stop making a list of what you need and what you're willing to pay for in foreign exchange. And liberalize your currency so that anybody who wants to buy anything from abroad can get the foreign exchange to do it. Now, this is an extraordinary prescription for a country that's in a balance of payments crisis. And that's why I say that they are causing these crises. And all of the other conditions they oppose.
Well, what was their rationale for doing that? How was that going to help the country?
Their rationale is basically that the way you balance your balance of payments is by attracting foreign creditors to send you more money. They do not look at the long-term consequences of it, or at least this look does not make any serious impact on their decisions.
And how has this debt crisis then been exacerbated by the development of markets and especially the computer revolution that basically allows money to travel around the world in seconds?
Well, the faster it goes, of course, the faster you can pull it out and cause a crisis. I don't know that the mechanism is that important, really. Just as I see the internet as just sort of a telephone substitute, which has certain advantages and disadvantages compared to the telephone. Of course, the whole issue of technology and how much people really, how much countries really do need foreign exchange to import technology is an open question which should be discussed. But the point is it should be discussed in that country. And it should be discussed in the context of foreign exchange budgeting. And budgeting is precisely what the IMF does not permit these countries to do.
We're talking to Cheryl Payer. She's the author of a number of books on the World Bank and IMF, including Lent and Lost, Foreign Credit and Third World Development, which is published by Zed Press, and her seminal book, The Debt Trap, the International Monetary Fund and the Third World. In the last months, the Congress has come up with a very critical report of the World Bank and the IMF. Can you tell us where that's coming from? And also how that compares to the criticism from the South.
Yes. I was very interested to read this past month a report that was just announced on March 5th. It's called informally the Meltzer Commission Report. Formally, it's the International Financial Institutions Advisory Committee Report. And this is a commission that was established by Congress as part of their last major appropriations to the IMF, with the assignment to study the IMF and see how it and the other international financial institutions should be reformed. And Congress is both a more progressive and a more reactionary body than the administration, and this report reflects that. I found it actually much more interesting than I had expected to read the Meltzer report, because it provides a lot of talking points which I think progressives can start from. Without talking anything about an alliance with the conservatives in Congress. We don't have to talk about an alliance. We can simply talk about what points they have established that we can agree on. For example, they agree that most of the debt of the South is unpayable. And they make a proposal for just writing off the IMF debts of these countries. Now, what's missing is they don't seem to say anything about writing off the private debts, which is, of course, in quantitative terms, much larger than the IMF debt. But still, it's a talking point and something that the South would certainly agree on. There's another report I've read recently, which is a report of an umbrella group of organizations coming from 35 different countries, notably none from North America, but from all the various continents of the South. And they met in Gauteng, South Africa in November. And they provided a sort of manifesto. And what they said about this particular point is, they said, the debt is illegitimate and immoral and has been paid many times over. The South people and countries are creditors of an enormous historical, social, and ecological debt which has been paid many times over. And they demand restitution and reparations. They reject conditional debt relief, and they also reject the effort of groups like the Meltzer Commission to divide them up, to slice them and dice them into countries according to how much debt they have and what their per capita income is, et cetera. So another point in which I was very happy to see in the Meltzer report was that they recognize that the problem these days is too large flows of capital rather than too little. Now, this is revolutionary, really, because the IMF, ever since its founding, has sort of chugged along on the autopilot of more is better. Foreign credit is better than domestic expansion. And the result is they've created this sorcerer's apprentice, this Frankenstein of sorts, where you now have these huge amounts of capital flowing around the world, not really creating development, and ready to pull out at a moment's notice, creating financial crises. So I think it's very important that this congressional commission has recognized that the problem is not too little capital, but too much.
Let me ask you, there's a meeting starting in Cuba this week, the group of 77, and one of the interesting issues that came out of Seattle was, when we were there, we interviewed many delegates who said that their nations were emboldened in their resistance to the WTO by the protests that they saw outside in the streets. And it's interesting that the Cuban government has said that the group of 77 will continue the rebellion that began in Seattle. Can you talk about how the countries of the Third World and of the South are becoming more assertive in their demands for equality in this whole issue of international finance?
Well, I think the South has been assertive for a long time. I wrote my first book back in the early 1970s by listening to what people in the South were saying at the time. The problem was we weren't hearing it here in this country, because this country wasn't suffering the effects of IMF programs. And so we had very little urgency or reason for understanding what they were saying, and it all sounded sort of vaguely good when we heard what the fund and the bank had to save for themselves. The interesting thing now is that with the World Trade Organization, American people and activists, environmental activists, labor activists, are for the first time feeling what the weight of an international institution, which is saying, no, we can invalidate the laws that you pass. Mm-hmm. We can say, you can't do that if you try to protect the sea turtles. You can't do that if you try to protect your labor. Even if you pass these laws, and usually, as we know, at great cost, we can invalidate them just at the time a committee meeting takes. And therefore, this is what seems to have galvanized Americans to understand what globalism is doing. And as a result, we have discovered an empathy toward what the peoples of the South have been enduring for many decades now.
So do you see the conservative forces in the United States joining, breaking down barriers with what's traditionally called the left? I mean, you've got this fierce critique from Congress that really comes from the right, but it could be shared as much by progressives.
I don't see any alliance happening, and I don't think it should, because I think in many ways the critique of, while I like many things in the Meltzer critique, I think a lot of it comes out of ignorance. They want basically the same thing. They want to impose free market ideology on the rest of the world. They just simply think that the IMF is doing a bad job of it because obviously it's not preventing financial crises, and it's got very bad PR these days, and they think they could do it better. Interestingly, the dissent in the Meltzer report, which is pretty much the democratically appointed commission members, and particularly Siegfried Bergsten, who has been a cheerleader for the IMF for many decades now, they rightly criticize the majority report as being unrealistic in thinking that it could achieve these aims with the means it proposes. And pretty much the Meltzer Commission is proposing shrinking the IMF back to something more resembling its original mandate of being quasi-automatic support for balance of payments crises. So I don't think it's a question of an alliance, but it is a question of using their points to achieve a sort of consensus, which cannot be denied.
Well,
and
Cheryl,
going from there.
Cheryl Payer, I want to thank you for being with us. She is the author of a number of books. It's first one, The Debt Trap, The International Monetary Fund, and The Third World, to Lent and Lost, Foreign Credit and Third World Development. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, as we continue our teaching, we're going to take a look at World Bank bonds and why activists are calling for a boycott. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. We're broadcasting from New York, though we're headed to Washington. In fact, Juan, you're going to Washington this afternoon to the National Press Club.
Yes, I'm going to be there at the this evening for a reception and a little talk on my book, Harvest of Empire.
The National Association of Hispanic Journalists are honoring you, as well as the Hispanic Link Journalism Foundation. As you hear all this, as you travel around the country, actually in your book tour, it's interesting that you're hitting the same cities that are involved in these really mobilizing campaigns, where everyone is also going to be headed to Washington, D.C. And in a funny way, your book parallels what's going on here. You're talking about why people came to this country in the last half of the 20th century.
Yes, and the enormous the impact of foreign investment, especially U.S. investment throughout Latin America, how it deformed those economies, yes.
Well, you're going to be at the National Press Club tonight at 6. Yesterday in the morning, also at the National Press Club, the place was packed because there was a news conference that was held on the issue of World Bank bonds. The World Bank raises almost all of its money from private financial markets. 80% of its funding comes from World Bank bonds, owned by private investors such as retirement funds, university endowments, churches, and local governments. And the group of people who had the news conference yesterday are calling for a boycott of these bonds. We're joined right now by two of the participants. Kevin Danaher is one of the founders of Global Exchange, and Dr. Vinita Gupta is also with us. She is a doctor from India and is with the 50 Years is Enough Network, and we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Be on the air with Amy.
Why don't we begin with you, Kevin? If you could explain what these World Bank bonds are all about.
Yeah, you got to give these guys credit. They're not stupid. It's a beautiful scam. They take our taxpayer money. They put that aside as collateral. It's called callable capital. They don't use it. They hold it in reserve. They use that few billion dollars to then issue tens of billions of dollars worth of bonds issued by the World Bank onto the commercial bond markets, where they tap money from, you know, Salomon Brothers and Citigroup and Japanese insurance companies and British banks and all these other rich folks. And then that money is what they use to create leverage, policy leverage, over third world elites. They go to third world elites and say, okay, we'll give you $300 million, but you've got to implement policies that we've written in Washington and Wall Street. Policies written in Washington and Wall Street is never going to bring real development to the third world. It's certainly not going to bring democracy. Because, as Dr. Gupta has pointed out in her research, it creates more accountability from third world elites to first world elites than those third world elites feel accountability to their own people. So our job is to break that linkage. So what we're doing in this campaign is going out to grassroots institutions, trade unions, city governments, universities, much as in the South Africa divestment movement, and saying to these institutions, we want a resolution from you saying that in the future you will not buy World Bank bonds. Now, financially, that's not even a mosquito bite, but in terms of public relations, the propaganda impact of it is to say to these institutional investors that are making the investments in these bonds, hey, we're going to attack the AAA rating of this bond, and we're going to knock it down to AA, maybe single A, maybe triple B. And if you invest your fund's money in those bonds, your butt's going to be on the line when you lose money on your investor's money and they come to you and say, hey, you knew about this World Bank bond boycott that drove down the value of these bonds that I can't sell and get my money back now, and you still invested in them. And if we drive down the value of those bonds, it's a bank, right? You hit them where it hurts. They love money, so we attack their god.
Well, Kevin, and how do these bonds work? Are they tax exempt bonds? Are they viewed as corporate bonds on the financial markets? How do their interest rates compare to those of other types of bonds?
Yeah, their interest rates actually compare very well. They've always carried a AAA rating. The World Bank has been issuing these since the 1940s, since the late 1940s. In fact, the World Bank has been a pioneer in what they call global bonds, that is, bonds that are issued in many of the industrial countries. Of course, they're not, you know, bothering to issue them in the third world countries. And you see the structure of this bond market sort of mirrors the power structure within the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The people who are in the executive positions of authority in these institutions are all from the rich countries, and the people who are borrowing are all from the former colonial countries. So what this amounts to is an extension of colonialism. Colonialism was people from wealthy imperial countries going and living in and controlling the economies of third world countries. They can't do that anymore and do it directly. So now they do it indirectly. They find local elites who will be happy to take the money, sign on the dotted line for the debt. And as Dr. Gupta points out in her research, India, for example, is now transferring more money back to these institutions than it gets in new loans. So the country is a net loser. And then in addition to that, you've got the political control that is exercised by all the structural adjustment policies, where the policies are dictated not from the grassroots up in the local economy, but from people living in mansions in Washington and Wall Street. It's absolutely crazy.
Kevin Danaher, one of the founders of Global Exchange. His latest book is Corporations Are Going to Get Your Mama, Globalization and the Downsizing of the American Dream.
Actually, Amy, could I correct that?
Yes.
I have a new book out, just came out yesterday. It's called Globalize This, the Battle Against the World Trade Organization and Corporate Rule. It will be available on the streets of Washington, D.C. I got a trunk full of them.
Who's your headline writer?
It came up in a group discussion, a brainstorming session.
Well, we're also joined on the telephone by Vinita Gupta, who is a doctor from India. Kevin was beginning to say some of the things that you've been talking about, but how does the World Bank affect the health of the people of India?
Well, World Bank has funded a health corporation by the name of Punjab Health Systems Corporation in our state in India. And it's a parastatal loan that the World Bank have given to Punjab. And after the corporation, the user fee was increased 10 times than before. And there was money for every service. And it took the treatment out of reach of the people's hands. And the poor people, I mean, because the state hospitals are mostly used by the poor people. And the leveling of the such high fee made health services out of reach of the poor people. And then there is so much corruption that even the money given by the World Bank to this corporation doesn't even get used properly. And we had done this reproductive and child health project in Punjab. This was also funded by World Bank. And $600 million were given for India, and some share came to Punjab. And we studied this in a very detailed manner, and there was so much corruption in it that the benefits didn't go to the people, but the debt did. The debt burden is increasing, but the benefits are not going because it's going into the corrupt politicians and the bureaucrats of our country, and World Bank is not bothered because its agenda is not to help the poor with health or alleviate the poverty. So it's adversely affecting our health system, and it's undermining the role of the state into providing basic health care, as India is a welfare state, and it has in its constitution as duty of the state to strive to provide better basic health care to its citizens in principal directives, and the right to health is totally undermined by this. Because you pay, you get the health services.
It sounds like they're trying to create an Indian healthcare system in the image of the U.S. healthcare system.
Pardon?
It sounds like they're trying to create the Indian healthcare system in the image of the U.S. healthcare system.
Yeah, but the things are different. Here people may be able to pay, but we are not able to pay. There's so many, more than 50% are below the poverty line.
Let me ask you, I know that in Mexico, there over the last 10, 15 years, there's been an enormous move toward privatization and selling off of government industry, and many of them actually in areas that were involved in some degree of health and welfare for the people. Has that been occurring in India as well, and has the World Bank played any role in that?
Yes, definitely. This is happening in India. It's health. Then it's electricity. Now there is a move to privatize drinking water. We don't even get drinking water in our villages as it is now, when the state is responsible for providing. And when it goes private under the aid of the World Bank, then it's really going to be out of the reach, totally.
Kevin Danaher, these World Bank bonds that subsidize the World Bank to impose these programs in countries like India, can you explain how exactly people get them? I mean, for example, people who invest in socially conscious investment firms, are they buying World Bank bonds?
Well, in fact, one of the things that we did at the press conference yesterday was we issued statements by Trillium Assets Management, Progressive Assets Management, Pax World Family Fund, Harrington Investments, Parnassus Investments, all of these different socially responsible investors who say it would be socially irresponsible to participate in supporting policies of the World Bank, and therefore Progressive Assets Management will not purchase bonds issued by the World Bank. We gave this all out to the press. We've got all sorts of churches, trade unions, Communication Workers of America have signed on, And this is just the beginning. This was just for the launch. We already had the city of Berkeley. It's moving through the city of Oakland, the city of San Francisco, Bloomington, Indiana. A whole bunch of other cities are considering it, and we're moving the process forward. For these institutions, it's very easy to sign on to this because it's not saying if you have them now, you got to sell them, because they can use a fiscal responsibility argument, because if you sell a bond before its maturity, you lose money on it. We're not saying that. We're saying in the future, you're going to promise that in the future you're not going to buy them. And that way it makes it real easy to get it through your school board, your local legislature, your trade union, fiscal manager, whatever. And there's literally a million bonds out there in the bond market. There's no need for any institution to buy World Bank bonds. So we're trying to make it real easy for people. And if I could give you the website, it's www.worldbankboycott, just like it sounds, World Bank Boycott, two T's in boycott, named after the Irishman, Captain Boycott, .org, worldbankboycott.org. There's also a number in Washington that people can call, 202-822-1180. That's 822-1180, and ask for extension 208. And there's a listserv you can get on that will automatically send you updates, not only about the campaign itself, but about the World Bank and why we're opposed to this institution and why we want to pull the plug on it and shut it down.
I should say that we invited the World Bank to be a part of this program to talk about the World Bank bond boycott, but they said that James Wolfensohn, the head of the World Bank and the bank, had not come out with a statement on it yet.
They chickened out, Amy. Well, they're afraid to debate us.
Well, Kevin, can we expect now that the World Bank will begin taking out major TV ads, piggybacking on Bill Gates' ads at the major basketball and football games around the country to improve their image?
You know, you say it with tongue-in-cheek, but it's already happening. I mean, think about this. When your opponent starts spewing forth your ideology, you know you've got them on the ropes. A few weeks ago, James Wolfensohn gave a press briefing, a luncheon. I spoke at a luncheon at the National Press Club, and I happened to be there in a ringside seat, and I almost fell out of my chair. I thought I was listening to the head of the Red Cross. The guy's talking about poverty and inequality. The last two words of his speech were social justice. And I'm like, wait a minute, for the past 50 years, you've been propping up the undemocratic elites that have foisted underdevelopment and undemocratic policies on the masses of the world, and you're talking about inequality being something you're going to do something about? The notion that people getting paid $300,000 a year and who are personally millionaires from their private lives as investment bankers are going to do something to eliminate poverty would be laughable in a sane world. This is absolutely crazy. But the fact that they are recycling our ideology and our language back at us shows we're having an impact. We've breached the outer wall of their defenses. We're inside the castle gates now, and we got to start thinking about not just protest culture, how we oppose these institutions, but what we're going to replace them with, a positive alternative.
What are you going to replace them
with?
Well,
in my new book, if I can put in a plug, the biggest section of the book is the last section of the book, which is a whole bunch of articles of legislative agenda, alternative investment principles, the fair trade movement, alternative trade principles, environmental regulations at a global level. We can see the foundation level already being constructed of an alternative system. Starbucks just announced that they're going to capitulate, they're going to sign up with Transfer USA and sell fair trade coffee in over 2,000 of their stores. That's a total victory for the corporate accountability movement. We forced them to do that by threatening them with a nationwide campaign. That means that there's going to be millions of dollars of wealth transferred from we, the wealthy elite, who will pay $2 for a cup of coffee, down to the poor family farmers who don't even have cement floors or running water in their homes, and they can afford donkeys to carry their 100-pound sacks of coffee beans instead of carrying them on their backs. That's what we got to do in the world, is redirect the wealth downward in the class structure. That's a lot of what this struggle is about. And we do it by democratizing capital. That should be our byword. Wherever capital exists and capital investment decision-making is being made, we got to democratize that process.
Well, Kevin Danaher and Vinita Gupta, we want to thank you very much for being with us. They both spoke at a national press conference yesterday calling for a boycott of World Bank bonds. And you can get more information on that by going to our website at www.democracynow.org to find out all the relevant information. WorldBankBoycott.org, as Kevin Danaher just said. If you'd like to write to us, us. You can send us email at democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland, our technical director. Matthew Finch, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.